The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the September 29th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The drawing on the front cover today is of a smiling Bernie Sanders, and he is wearing a physician's lab coat, white coat, with a stethoscope around his neck, and in the foreground he's holding a pill bottle, and it reads, RX Bernie Care, single payer health care, take one pill for everything. The title on the cover says, Bernie's Cure-All, Will Americans Ever Embrace Single Payer Health Care? I think we'll get that article on the Talking Points page, but we'll start as usual with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's defiant debut at the UN, what happened? President Donald Trump struck a defiant and confrontational tone in his maiden speech to the United Nations General Assembly this week, vowing to totally destroy North Korea if it threatens U.S. or its allies, denouncing the 2015 nuclear disarmament deal with Iran as an embarrassment, and urging fellow world leaders to embrace national sovereignty. In a fiery address that drew mostly stony silence, some light applause, and occasional gasps from some members of the 193 international delegations, Trump denounced the depraved regime in Pyongyang for recent ballistic missile and nuclear tests, and said Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un, whom he mocked as Rocket Man, was on a suicide mission. Describing rogue regimes as the scourge of our planet, the president suggested he would seek to renegotiate the one-sided nuclear deal with the murderous government in Tehran, and threatened the socialist dictatorship in Venezuela with further sanctions. Trump also warned of the growing threat from radical Islamic terrorism and promised he wouldn't allow loser terrorists to tear up the entire world. In an explanation of his America First foreign policy, Trump promised that the U.S. would forever be a great friend to the world, but said he wouldn't let his country be taken advantage of or enter into one-sided agreements. He implored other world leaders to do the same, stressing the value of strong, sovereign nations. The U.S. doesn't seek to impose our way of life on anyone, he said, but rather to let it shine as an example for everyone to watch. What the editorial said. Much of what the president told delegates in New York was directly on point, said the Los Angeles Times. The UN should do more to address violations of human rights and national sovereignty by the authoritarian regimes in Pyongyang, Tehran, and Caracas. But the president's message was undermined by his needlessly offensive tone and juvenile insults, threatening to annihilate an entire country of 25 million people, describing Iran as a rogue state whose chief exports are violence, bloodshed, and chaos. This guns-blazing rhetoric may sound tough, but it achieves nothing and is, in fact, counterproductive. Trump's Rocket Man jibe was straight out of the schoolyard, said the Wall Street Journal, but he deserves credit for trying to focus a cynical world's attention on an increasingly perilous situation. Traditional diplomacy hasn't altered the thinking of either Kim or his patrons in Beijing, and Trump's speech signaled that unless something changes, he intends to do something about it. What the columnist said. It used to be international pariahs like Libyan leader Muammar al-Qaddafi and Venezuela's Hugo Chavez who spouted hateful nonsense to the General Assembly, said Ryu Spaeth in NewRepublic.com. Now it's the President of the United States. If Americans ever wondered what it's like to be led by a wild-eyed megalomaniac, now we know. The Trump doctrine, if there is one, is intellectually confused, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. He claimed every government should respect the national sovereignty of other nations, yet in the same breath threatened North Korea and Venezuela. He chided Cuba and Iran for human rights violations, but said nothing about the similarly dreadful records of Russia, Saudi Arabia, or Turkey. Why? Their leaders flatter him. Let's be fair here, said Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. Every recent U.S. administration has made exceptions for authoritarian governments it needed to work with. They've also all promised to defend America's interests against aggressive rogue regimes. The truth is, for all the huffing and puffing over the shocking language in Trump's speech, the substance was remarkably similar to that of his predecessors. But tone matters a great deal in international relations, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. Diplomats know it's important to treat their adversaries with respect and provide them a dignified way to retreat from their original positions. Trump did the exact opposite, ridiculing Kim and signaling that Pyongyang's only option was to give up its entire nuclear program. If Kim crosses the red line Trump has drawn, the president will have only two options, back down or go to war. If he chooses war, the Rocket Man speech will be remembered as one of the first steps that took us there. Along the same lines, we're going to read a second main story that says the U.S. mulls military action against North Korea. What happened? The Pentagon warned this week that it was weighing several military options in response to North Korea's nuclear weapons program amid escalating tensions between the Trump administration and Kim Jong-un's regime. North Korea fired a second ballistic missile over Japan last week, prompting President Trump to threaten to totally destroy the rogue state during an address at the United Nations. As the U.S. flew bombers and stealth jets over the Korean Peninsula in a show of force, Defense Secretary James Mattis indicated that he was assessing military responses to Pyongyang's provocations that would not put Seoul's 10 million residents at risk of a devastating counterattack. Those options reportedly include a naval blockade, a, quote, decapitation operation to kill Kim, a limited strike on weapon sites, and shooting down North Korean missiles even if they don't directly threaten the U.S. or its allies. Asked if he was considering kinetic action, a euphemism for lethal military force, Mattis replied, "Yes, I don't want to go into that." North Korea's latest missile test came days after the UN Security Council tightened sanctions on Kim's regime for detonating its sixth nuclear device. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, said that the U.S. had pretty much exhausted all the things we could do at the Security Council, and that if diplomacy doesn't work, General Mattis will take care of it. What the columnist said: traditionally, where diplomacy and sanctions fail, military force begins, said Steve Gagnard in ABCNews.com. But it would be almost impossible for the Trump administration to neutralize North Korea's nuclear threat without starting a world war. The U.S. doesn't know where the Hermit Kingdom has hidden all of its weapons and may not have the capability to shoot down its ballistic missiles without moving ships into the North Korean waters. Moreover, it would take a days-long air campaign to destroy the 8,000 cannons and rocket launchers on Pyongyang's side of the demilitarized zone, giving Kim ample time to retaliate against Seoul and kill hundreds of thousands. Basically, it's time to recognize that North Korea is a nuclear power, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. We've failed at forcing Kim to get rid of his nuclear arsenal. The most effective way to proceed now is through deterrence and diplomacy. If Trump opens up talks, maybe he can get the North Korean leader to limit the size of his arsenal, which currently includes 20 nuclear weapons. Better 20 than 100 or 200. What good will talks do? Asked Jed Babin in Spectator.org. Nothing. No economic sanctions, no diplomatic maneuvers will stop Kim from building a nuclear arsenal that guarantees his regime's survival. His nation is already a pariah state, and the despot doesn't care if millions of his own people starve. He's already developed his nuclear and missile forces to the point that he can threaten about one-third of the continental U.S. All told, the Rocket Man has got us where he wants us. Our controversy of the week, ESPN, should an anchor be fired for anti-Trump tweets? President Trump has made no secret of his contempt for the free press, said Will Bunch in Philly.com. But this week he launched one of the most breathtaking abuses of the First Amendment that I've witnessed in my lifetime. The target was Jemele Hill, an African-American sports anchor on ESPN, who last week on Twitter called Trump a white supremacist, whose election was a direct result of white supremacy, period. Trump, as usual, responded with an angry tweet of his own, demanding an apology and blaming ESPN's slumping viewership on its bad politics. But he didn't stop there. The next day, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders urged ESPN to treat Hill's comments as a fireable offense. It's deeply chilling when the federal government uses its power to try to get a journalist fired for expressing an opinion, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. It's also hypocritical. Before and after he began running for president, Trump repeatedly called President Obama a racist, insisted he was foreign-born and therefore an illegitimate president, and even accused him of being a secret Muslim who sympathized with Islamist terrorists. Should NBC have fired Donald Trump from The Apprentice for those utterly unfounded slurs? The double standard here is ESPN, said Brian Flood in FoxNews.com. Last year, the network fired baseball analyst Curt Schilling for expressing his conservative views on Twitter, including his retweet of a satirical image of a hairy fat guy in a dress demanding access to a girl's bathroom. The black liberal Hill got away with only a mild reprimand from ESPN, while the white conservative Schilling lost his job. That's because ESPN is now an unabashedly left-wing network, said John Calvin in Spectator.org. It's devoted endless hours to lauding former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick for his Black Lives Matter protest during the national anthem. And last week, host Stephen A. Smith praised a banner unfurled at a Boston Red Sox game that stated, "Racism is as American as baseball." If Jemele Hill deserves firing for calling Trump a white supremacist, said Leonard Pitts Jr. in the Miami Herald, then what does Trump deserve for actually being one? The young Trump and his father, let's remember, were sued for refusing to rent apartments to black tenants. While running for president, Trump described illegal Mexican immigrants as rapists and complained that an Indiana-born judge was unfit to preside over a lawsuit involving Trump because he was a Mexican. His birther campaign was nakedly racist. Trump's supporters were thrilled by such bigotry because it was politically incorrect, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. But when Kaepernick dared to protest police shootings of black males, and Hill called out Trump for praising some very fine people at a Charlottesville, Virginia rally organized by neo-Nazis and white supremacists, outraged white Americans demanded that those mouthy blacks lose their jobs. In America, it seems, protesting racism might make you a pariah. Indulging it might put you in the Oval Office. What does any of this have to do with sports? Asked the Washington Examiner in an editorial. Maybe ESPN wouldn't be suffering steadily declining ratings if it didn't impose its left-wing moral posturing on its viewers and went back to focusing on games, reporting scores, and breaking down the big plays. That being said, the White House's call for Hill to be fired smacks of an effort to chill speech, which is simply not how we do things in America. We wish Team Trump would not stoop so low. It was a good week for the sincerest form of flattery. After New York plastic surgeon Dr. Norman Rowe said that over the past year, about 50 women paid up to $50,000 each for procedures that would make them look like Ivanka Trump. The permanent Ivanka includes widened cheekbones, a slender nose, and large eyes. It was a good week for shaving your head after University of Pennsylvania researchers found that men with totally bald pates are seen as more dominant and confident than men with hair, though less attractive. And it was a good week for gun shows after President Trump said he is considering holding a large military parade down Pennsylvania Avenue next July 4th that will top France's Bastille Day parade. As we build up our military, Trump said, we're going to display our military. But it was a bad week for retweets after President Trump retweeted a video from an anti-Semitic and racist Twitter troll that shows him hitting a golf ball at Hillary Clinton and knocking her down. This has to stop, said former Vice President Joe Biden. Our children are watching. It was a bad week for growing up after a study revealed that today's teens are taking longer to embrace traditional symbols of adulthood, including getting a driver's license, drinking, and dating. The whole developmental pathway has slowed down, said study author Gene Twinge. And finally, it was a bad week for loose lips after White House lawyer Ty Cobb loudly discussed the Mueller investigation at a Washington, D.C. steakhouse with a New York Times reporter at the next table. Cobb said, among other things, that the White House has a couple of documents locked in a safe that Mueller might want. And while we're here, a short, boring, but important item. White House nixes refugee study. The Trump administration has reportedly rejected the results of a government study that found that over the past decade, refugees to the U.S. brought in $63 billion more in state and local taxes than they cost in public benefits. Trump's chief policy advisor, Stephen Miller, who has advocated for the president to further lower the 50,000 refugee annual cap Trump put in place, argued in internal White House discussions that only the costs, not any fiscal benefits, of the refugee program should be considered, according to the New York Times, which obtained a draft copy of the report. The final report concluded that refugees consume more in benefits per capita than the average American, omitting any mention of their economic contribution. On the briefing page this week, when the water rises. Severe flooding is becoming increasingly common in the U.S. and more destructive. How bad is the problem? Flooding is the most costly type of natural disaster in the U.S., responsible for an average of 140 deaths and $6 billion worth of damage each year. Hurricane Harvey, which dumped 50 inches of rain on Houston last month, was the Texas City's third 500-year flood in 3 years. A 500-year flood theoretical has a 1 in 500 chance of happening in any given year. Extreme rainstorms worldwide are up more than a third since the early 1980s. Miami Beach, Florida experienced 33 flood events between 2006 and 2013, compared with just 16 in the seven preceding years. By the middle of the century, a majority of U.S. coastal areas are expected to be hit with 30 or more days of flooding each year. Harvey wasn't the storm of the millennium, said David Conrad, a consultant for the Association of State Floodplain Managers. It's going to happen again and again. What's behind the increase? Climate change. Rising sea levels, the result of glaciers and ice caps melting in warmer temperatures, make storm surges along coastal areas much worse. Warmer oceans also evaporate faster, and warmer air can hold more moisture, meaning big storms can absorb and dump larger volumes of water. And higher sea temperatures give brewing storms more energy to feed off. When Harvey formed over the Gulf of Mexico, sea surface temperatures were as much as 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit above the historical average. Some climate scientists believe global warming has also weakened the prevailing winds that move weather systems around, exacerbating heavy rainstorms, heat spells, droughts, and other extremes. That phenomenon might explain why Harvey stalled over Houston for 5 days. With temperatures and sea levels rising, oceans are expected to rise by 8 feet by 2100. Flooding is only going to get worse. We are not going to stop these events from occurring, said Alex Kaplan of the reinsurance company Swiss Re. They are going to become more frequent, and we should plan for that scenario. Which areas are the most vulnerable? Nearly 10 million U.S. households sit in 100-year floodplains, mostly on the Gulf and Atlantic coast. Among the most vulnerable cities are Boston, New York, Tampa, Miami Beach, and New Orleans. But location isn't the only factor. Another is overdevelopment. When cities spread out across large areas, developers often pave over the grasslands and wetlands that would otherwise absorb excess water. Houston, which has no citywide zoning laws, is a good example. Dubbed the Wild West of development, the oil and gas hub laid concrete over 30% of its surrounding wetlands between 1992 and 2010, some 25,000 acres. To make matters worse, much of the city's expansion has been in flood-prone areas. At least 7,000 residential buildings have gone up since 2010 in the city's 100-year floodplains. Why build in flood zones? One major factor is insurance. While normal homeowners' policies do not cover flooding, the government's National Flood Insurance Program, NFIP, offers artificially cheap premiums to residents and businesses in at-risk areas. This program covers about half of all the properties in 100-year floodplains. Protected by these generous policies, which pay out up to $250,000 for property damage and $100,000 for contents, people feel emboldened to build in at-risk areas and to rebuild in the same place that their homes are flooded. The NFIP currently insures 30,000 severe repetitive loss properties, which have been rebuilt at least 4 times. One home in Mississippi, valued at $69,000, has flooded 34 times, accumulating $663,000 in claims. Many believe the NFIP, currently almost $25 billion in debt, needs a major overhaul. If you had to pay the full cost of a risk, said Carolyn Kuski of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, Wharton's Risk Management Center, that might discourage people from living in really risky areas. Are solutions possible? Congress passed a bill in 2012 to make NFIP premiums reflect risk, but essentially reversed those changes 2 years later because of intense political pressure from homeowners and developers. Cities have tried buying up and demolishing properties in floodplains, enacting tougher building codes, and erecting warning signs to show how high previous floods have risen. But they often face fierce resistance from developers and politicians, particularly in places such as Florida, where real estate development is integral to the economy. Another issue is that many Republican politicians continue to downplay the dangers of climate change. Under a directive from Governor Rick Scott, Florida's Department of Environmental Protection, for example, reportedly prohibited its 3,200 employees from using the words climate change or global warming in any official communications. But many hope Harvey and Hurricane Irma, which pummeled Florida 2 weeks later, will jolt politicians and the public into adopting new policies to mitigate the risks of severe flooding. We know it's more cost-effective to take these actions up front instead of just waiting for a disaster to strike, says Rebecca Hammer of the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council. It's just a matter of political will and funding. And we'll turn our attention now to a few of the best columns of the week. The first from the U.S., titled Normalizing Violent Protests. No serious violence broke out when conservative journalist Ben Shapiro gave a speech at the University of California, Berkeley last week, said Megan McCardle. But the bad news is that Berkeley had to spend $600,000 to lock down much of the campus, fill it with police armed with pepper spray, and erect concrete barriers to keep leftist Antifa away from the event. Is this what it now takes to maintain order in the face of a speech? Liberals who loathe President Trump fear that he will be normalized, but the deep rage and contempt of this president has inspired has led to the normalization of lots of other bad things, including riots and the suppression of the right to speak and peacefully assemble. The radical left believes that some people, ranging from white supremacists to ordinary Trump supporters to even mild anti-Trump conservatives like Shapiro, are too dangerous to have rights and should be prevented from exercising their First Amendment rights, with fists and clubs and thrown bottles if necessary. So now we have to spend $600,000 to keep a rather ordinary speech from turning into a bloody riot. We cannot become inured to how outrageous this is. This is not normal, and it's not American. This column comes from Germany. The true cost of accepting migrants. The German government is being uncharacteristically cagey about just how much refugees are costing the nation, said Wolfgang Bach. Since 2014, 1.7 million people, most of them unskilled and uneducated, have applied for asylum in Germany. And worried citizens are outraged over the lack of information about how the country is coping. For a nation that typically tots up the cost of every bolt and screw, this suspicious dearth of hard data can only be explained by fear of what voters would say if they knew how vast the sums were. For example, The budget allots about $110 billion to provide for refugees from 2016 to 2020. Since Germany's states say that covers just half their expenses, the true cost for that period is probably $210 billion. Even that sum does not include funding for thousands of new schools, much less the hiring of additional judicial and bureaucratic staff to process the asylum requests. Nor does it include the cost of treating the drastic increase in dangerous infectious diseases, such as tuberculosis and AIDS, that have come into the country with the refugees. Over their lives, these people will cost Germany hundreds of billions of dollars. That is the elephant in the room that everyone pretends not to see. This comes from North Korea. It's an editorial from the Global Times in China, and it's titled, "It's Not a Good Idea to Mock Kim." U.S. President Donald Trump does not understand diplomacy in the context of Asia, said the Global Times. When speaking by phone to South Korean President Moon Jae-in last week, Trump called North Korean leader Kim Jong-un Rocket Man for his habit of testing ever more powerful ballistic missiles. He then used the pejorative name on Twitter for the entire world to see. It's probably no big deal to use nicknames in American culture, but this is not a freewheeling political campaign. It is nuclear diplomacy. In North Korea, mocking the leader is a capital offense. If Kim takes Trump's throwaway comment as a deliberate insult, Pyongyang may become more hostile to Washington, adding fuel to the fire of the current confrontation. And if Trump really did mean to provoke him, then his strategy is definitely neither masterful nor morally justifiable. The North Korean regime is not an eccentric, unpredictable actor, as Westerners mistakenly think. It has a classical geopolitical mindset, believing it can preserve its existence only through military strength. The regime is preoccupied with being respected on the world stage. It is never appropriate for world leaders to engage in name-calling. For Trump and Kim, such behavior could have deadly consequences. We'll take a look now at the last word, our in-depth article this week titled, "The Enduring Power of Mugshots." Americans love to gawk at mugshots, whether they're of a fallen celebrity or a tattooed drug addict, said journalist Tim Stello. But in the digital age, these booking photos can haunt those pictured for years. On a cold, rainy morning last January, Matthew Medland hopped a freight car in downtown Portland, Oregon, and headed north. When he arrived at a train yard a few miles away, he felt something he said he often feels, a kind of magnetism that he's come to think of as a supernatural force. Medlin is 33 and, when he's not behind bars, homeless. He has dagger-like stripes tattooed above his eyes and four dots below them, symbols of what he described as his belief in lycanthropy, the mythical transformation of humans into wolves. He's a habitual methamphetamine user for years. He's schizophrenic. In Medlin's telling, that something in the railroad yard was a person in danger. What followed, however, was not a rescue effort, but a five-hour standoff with police in which Medlin exhibited all manner of distressing behaviors, according to court documents. He tinkered with the brake system on a liquid propane car. He injected himself with methamphetamines. He pleaded with police not to shoot him. he appeared to threaten them with shards of scrap metal. The confrontation, which ended when one of the officers tasered Medlin, was an unusual one that no doubt would have made local news. But Medlin's story quickly spiraled across national and international media for a single reason. The series of mugshots he'd collected over the years proved irresistible. They portrayed a tragic, intensely visual parable. As the UK Sun put it, shocking mugshots reveal how methamphetamine and a life of crime ruined young man's model good looks. In the burst of coverage that followed, there were scant details about Medlin's backstory. Not who he was, where he came from, or that he denied much of what was contained in the court documents. Tiger Woods, whose eyes at half-mast mug went viral after he was arrested in Florida this summer for driving under the influence, can probably sympathize. But why did we see these images in the first place? The simple answer is as routine as the booking photo itself. They're public documents. But there's a more complicated answer, too. Since the U.S., paradoxically, professes a belief in blind justice while eagerly distributing photos of its accused, it's not that police departments in, say, England or Canada don't collect photographs of the people they've arrested. They just release them only when there's an important reason to. There's a jailbreak, say, or a murderer on the loose. As Eddie Townsend, spokesman for the City of London Police, put it, it goes back to the principle of innocent until proven guilty. This strange cultural idiosyncrasy can be traced back more than a century, to when the photograph was among the lawman's most sophisticated criminal identification tools. But over the decades, the booking photo evolved into something quite different. Now the images are available from an expansive roster of mugshot purveyors, everyone from crime-fighting social media groups to privately run online databases that, in some cases, have been described as extortion operations. They post booking photographs online, then charge exorbitant fees to remove them. The result is a ubiquitous frame-by-frame reality show depicting alleged crime and justice and starring the petty thief and the celebrity cokehead, the wrongly accused killer and the mentally ill drug addict. Free expungement clinics help the more desperate among them to scrub their criminal records, while firms like erasemugshots.com offer removal services for a fee. Lawyers in Illinois, Florida, and beyond have taken their grievances to court, and lawmakers in more than a dozen states have tried reeling in the more pernicious practices of some mugshot entrepreneurs. Last year, a panel of federal appeals judges weighed in on the whole internet-fueled enterprise, denying a newspaper's request for U.S. Marshals booking photos. Mugshots now present an acute problem in the digital age, wrote the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals Chief Judge R. Guy Cole, Jr. These images preserve the indignity of a deprivation of liberty, often at the literal expense of the most vulnerable among us. It wasn't always this way. What began more than 150 years ago with wanted posters and rogues galleries had, by the last decade of the 19th century, evolved. In Paris, the record clerk, turning pioneering criminologist Alphonse Bertillon, developed the modern booking photograph. One frontal shot, one profile. And in the U.S., the argument for mass distribution came from one of the country's most celebrated inspectors, the New York Police Department's Thomas Burns. In Burns' seminal 1886 collection of 204 images, Professional Criminals of America, he described the practice as crime prevention's par excellence, a system where there weren't just a few sets of eyes surveilling a new class of elusive criminal, but thousands. With the emergence of crime and celebrity-driven media, the mugshot became a staple of American culture. It could distill a historic moment like the arrest of O.J. Simpson, said Jonathan Finn, a professor of communications at Wilfrid Laurier University and author of Capturing the Criminal Image, From Mugshot to Surveillance Society. There are thousands and thousands of mugshots, he said, but O.J. is O.J. Then the internet happened. Sheriff's offices in large and tiny counties alike now post mugshots to slick, constantly updated websites. Under its notorious former sheriff, Joe Arpaio, Maricopa County even held a contest in which visitors voted on a mugshot of the day. Local TV affiliates offer them in slideshows, while arrest.org lets readers tag and comment on them. Jailbase.com shuffles them through a smartphone app, and thesmokinggun.com assembles them into all manner of categories that include cleavage, fogies, and B-list. Even the Tampa Bay Times, which prominently displays its Pulitzer Prize tally, 12, compiles them alongside a list of physical attributes, gender, height, weight. The images vanish after 60 days from a section that clocks nearly 1 million views a month, said the paper's editor, Neil Brown. While he put the site's news value at the lowest possible level, he says that such eyeball-grabbing schemes aren't unusual. The slippery slope of being a purist is that there's all kinds of stuff on news sites all over the country that is there for the interest of the audience, he said. I don't think sanctimony over it is entirely well placed, though I don't begrudge anyone their sanctimony. Why are people so obsessed with these photos? Rutgers sociologist Sarah Esther Lagesson, who has been studying the explosion of digital mugshots for nearly a decade, said that they offer a view not just into the darker recesses of someone's life, but into an essential government process that many of us never see or experience. It's also a public act of shaming, she said. It helps us draw a line around what's acceptable. To Trevor Whipple, the police chief in South Burlington, Vermont, the mugshot was a powerful means of transparency. At least that's what he thought when his department began posting them to its Facebook page a few years ago. As he put it, who are we arresting? Profiling is a significant concern. This is, well, we'll let you see everybody in custody. Then came the angry phone calls from people who'd been arrested and then cleared or had their charges expunged. In one case, Whipple said, a mother called about her 19-year-old daughter, whose DWI arrest had produced a tear and mascara streaked image that was being repeatedly reposted. She said, my daughter, this was the low point of her life, but people keep going to her mugshot on your Facebook, he recalled. All of this gave Whipple pause. How, he thought, will these images affect someone who shouldn't have been arrested in the first place? In the end, he said, it was the comments that did it. We saw people playing off personal characteristics. He doesn't look smart. He looks like a doofus, Whipple recalled. I thought, have we run out the usefulness of this? I don't want to have people humiliated. On July 4, 2015, after a roughly year-long experiment in social media transparency, Whipple posted a note on his department's Facebook page declaring it dead. Whipple's concerns weren't misplaced. Lagesson interviewed 27 people at Minnesota expungement clinics over the next 2 years, beginning in 2014, and found that people had been fired and rejected from jobs or scared to even apply in the first place. One woman had been unable to find decent housing. Another was kicked out of her church. The photos were decades old in some cases, and the people pictured in them had no idea they were online until they popped up, as Lagesson recalled many of them saying. Most of the people Lagesson interviewed didn't bother contacting the sites that were publishing their images. They had been too overwhelmed or confused about whom to contact. Some thought it wouldn't do any good. Consider mugshots.com, for example, which describes itself as a search engine for official law enforcement records. A mission, it says, is protected by an assortment of federal and state laws and two constitutional amendments. Not everyone has been chastened by this seemingly impenetrable legal defense. In Illinois, three men seeking class action status filed a suit last year describing the site as an extortion racket that deliberately and routinely published inaccurate information for a single purpose, to drive people to a prominently advertised sister site, unpublishedarrest.com, where for removal services they spent anywhere from $399 to $1,799. They were deliberately trying to use this information as a cudgel to beat people with because they are desperate enough to pay that kind of money, said Stuart Clark, one of the lawyers who filed the suit. A lawyer for mugshots.com, David Ferrucci, denied this, insisting in an interview that the site is as much a crime blog as anything else. As evidence, he pointed to aggregated posts on its homepage about accused sexual predators and murders and compared it to the Chicago Tribune's Mugs in the News. Besides, Ferrucci added, shouldn't the focus be on the draconian elements of our justice system and not the pictures of the people it locks up? Instead of shooting the messenger, the purveyor of public records, maybe we should lessen the impact of the prison industrial complex, he said. That's really the tragedy here, how easy it is to get arrested. Lawyers like Ferrucci and sites like mugshots.com aren't the only ones fighting for continued broad access to booking photos. Journalists are too. In 2013, the Detroit Free Press sued the Justice Department after it refused to release mugshots of four police officers accused of corruption. Dozens of news organizations and press advocacy groups backed up the newspaper in court, including the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. A lawyer there, Adam Marshall, defended the mugshot as a memorialization of one of the most important processes of the criminal justice system, the arrest. There are a whole bunch of details the photo can give us, he said. What if the police arrested the wrong person? What if the officer assaulted that person? The public expects information from the government about what they're doing, Marshall said. The photo provides the public with that information in a way that a name doesn't. Back in Portland, inside the drab interview room of Multnomah County's downtown jail, Matthew Medlin wasn't sure what to think about how his mugshots had turned him into a grim kind of celebrity. He viewed the images in part in those terms. It's kind of cool that I'm being glorified a little bit, he said, though he hoped their impact wouldn't stop there. If there's a reason or a chance that this can actually benefit me or people like me, he said, then maybe somewhere down the road it'll help us get the help that we need. That remains to be seen, but Medlin seemed hopeful about his prospects. For the first time in his life, he had been moved from a jail cell to Oregon's main psychiatric hospital in the state capital, Salem, where he was signing up for classes on, among other things, how to deal with cognitive mental illness and how to defend himself in court. It's just a good rehabilitation vibe, he said. It's well needed, I think. This was excerpted from an article originally published by the Marshall Project. We'll pick up one of the health and science shorts, this one titled Yoga's Brain Boost. Yoga and meditation are becoming increasingly mainstream activities in the U.S., and new research helps explain why. Daily sessions of either practice can have dramatic effects on brain function. Scientists asked 31 healthy people to engage in 25 minutes of hatha yoga, mindfulness meditation, and quiet reading in random order. Mental tasks completed before and after each session found that yoga and meditation led to greater improvements in the participants' energy level, mood, executive function, and ability to control thoughts and emotions. Hatha yoga and mindfulness meditation both focus the brain's conscious processing power on a limited number of targets, like breathing and posing, and also reduce processing of non-essential information, the study's co-author Peter Hall tells ScienceDaily.com. That mental training, he said, apparently enables people to focus more easily on what they choose to attend to in everyday life. And we'll move on over to the talking points page, getting back to that story that the cover picture alluded to. Single-payer health care, the new litmus test for Democrats. The Democratic Party now is, for all intents and purposes, the party of single-payer health insurance, said Bill Scheer in Politico.com. Last week, former Democratic presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders introduced the latest version of his revolutionary single-payer health care system, named the Medicare for All Act of 2017. The last time the self-declared Democratic socialists introduced such legislation, he didn't have a single co-sponsor for the simple reason single payer would require a total transformation of the U.S. healthcare system and a brutal, polarizing national debate. This time, 15 Senate Democrats lined up to put their names on his bill, including likely 2020 presidential contenders Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Elizabeth Warren. Bernie's plan is like the UK's national health system, but on steroids, said Van R. Newkirk II in TheAtlantic.com. The program would cover everyone and, well, everything. Doctor visits, drugs, home care, specialty care, and even vision and dental benefits with no deductibles, co-payments, or co-insurance whatsoever. Right now, with Republicans in control of Capitol Hill, the initiative is almost certainly doomed. But single-payer is now officially a liberal rallying point, one firmly at the center of Democratic policymaking for years to come. Bernie's health care plan is a complete joke, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. It would add hundreds of millions of people into an already financially strapped program, lowering the Medicare eligibility age to 55 and insuring all children in the first year, and then expanding the program to include all age groups over the next 3 years. That could cost an absurd $32 trillion over the next decade, according to the Liberal Urban Institute. Yet ask Sanders how he plans to pay for doubling federal spending, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post, and the Vermont Senator punts. His legislation doesn't include any financing, though Sanders did suggest in a separate white paper raising the top marginal tax rate to 52% from today's 39.6%, a new 4% health care tax on households, a 7.5% payroll tax on employers, and other taxes. Won't Americans suffer sticker shock over these tax increases? Aren't they the reason Vermont, California, and New Jersey balked when trying to pass similar single-payer plans? Ask these simple questions of the Sanders camp, and you'll be branded a corporate shill or worse. Sanders' plan ignores another inconvenient truth, said Matthew Continetti in NationalReview.com. Some 156 million Americans have employer-based insurance, and the two-thirds that are happy with their coverage won't take kindly to having it cavalierly removed in the name of Sanders' revolution. Similarly, don't forget the entrenched interests of providers, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Doctors, hospitals, and drug companies will fight to the death against Sanders' plan, which seeks to reduce some costs by imposing strict price controls on what providers get paid. if the Democrats' goal is universal coverage, there are several boring, incremental ways to achieve this, including offering Americans without insurance a public option to buy into Medicare. Alas, pragmatism was never Bernie's forte. In his simplistic worldview, he thinks only evil drug companies and corporations would oppose free medicine for all, never realizing that the most important source of opposition will come from actual American voters concerned about losing their current plan or paying higher taxes. Progressives still insisting on realistic and common sense health care reform are living in the political past, said Paul Rosenberg in Salon.com. If the old pragmatic assumptions about our politics still existed, Sanders never would have won a single primary in 2016, and Donald Trump certainly wouldn't be the president today. Americans demand fundamental change. Just a few years ago, single payer was a fringe idea. Now, a Kaiser Family Foundation poll finds 53% of Americans support it. With Bernie's plan, Democrats can present voters with a positive, aspirational message in the 2018 midterms and beyond. Let's be clear, Medicare for All has little chance of ever being enacted, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. Americans are still far too distrustful of big government and would never accept such massive tax increases. Still, the Vermont senator has done a remarkable thing. By making single payer the central legacy of his extraordinary 2016 campaign, he has fundamentally changed the health care debate. In the future, any Democratic proposal to improve the health care system will be bolder and further to the left than ever before, moving the country closer to universal coverage. It's Sanders who has put them on that path. And we will have to leave it at that today. We've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. I am Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.